This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by David Barnes. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 3, Part 1. I intend in this chapter to give a description of the state in which England was at the time when the crown passed from Charles II to his brother. Such a description, composed from scanty and dispersed materials, must necessarily be very imperfect, yet it may perhaps correct some false notions which would make the subsequent narrative unintelligible or uninstructive. If we would study with profit the history of our ancestors, we must be constantly on our guard against that delusion which the well-known names of families, places, and offices naturally produce, and must never forget that the country of which we read was a very different country from that in which we live. In every experimental science there is a tendency towards perfection. In every human being there is a wish to ameliorate his own condition. These two principles have often sufficed, even when counteracted by great public calamities and by bad institutions, to carry civilization rapidly forward. No ordinary misfortune, no ordinary misgovernment, will do so much to make a nation wretched as the constant progress of physical knowledge and the constant effort of every man to better himself will do to make a nation prosperous. It has often been found that profuse expenditure, heavy taxation, absurd commercial restrictions, corrupt tribunals, disastrous wars, seditions, persecutions, conflagrations, inundations, have not been able to destroy capital so fast as the exertions of private citizens have been able to create it. It can easily be proved that in our own land the national wealth has, during at least 6 centuries, been almost uninterruptedly increasing, that it was greater under the Tudors than under the Plantagenets, that it was greater under the Stuarts than under the Tudors, that, in spite of battles, sieges, and confiscations, it was greater on the day of the Restoration than on the day when the Long Parliament met, that, in spite of maladministration, of extravagance, of public bankruptcy, of 2 costly and unsuccessful wars, of the pestilence and of the fire, it was greater on the day of the death of Charles II than on the day of his restoration. This progress, having continued during many ages, became at length, about the middle of the 18th century, portentously rapid, and has proceeded, during the 19th, with accelerated velocity. In consequence, partly of our geographical and partly of our moral position, we have, during several generations, been exempt from evils which have elsewhere impeded the efforts and destroyed the fruits of industry. While every part of the continent, from Moscow to Lisbon, has been the theatre of bloody and devastating wars, no hostile standard has been seen here but as a trophy. While revolutions have taken place all around us, our government has never once been subverted by violence. During more than 100 years, there has been in our island no tumult of sufficient importance to be called an insurrection. Nor has the law been once borne down, either by popular fury or by regal tyranny. Public credit has been held sacred. The administration of justice has been pure. Even in times which might by Englishmen be justly called evil times, we have enjoyed what almost every other nation in the world would have considered as an ample measure of civil and religious freedom. Every man has felt entire confidence that the state would protect him in the possession of what had been earned by his diligence and hoarded by his self-denial. under the benignant influence of peace and liberty, science has flourished and has been applied to practical purposes on a scale never before known. The consequence is that a change to which the history of the old world furnishes no parallel has taken place in our country. Could the England of 1685 be, by some magical process, set before our eyes, we should not know one landscape in 100, or one building in 10,000. The country gentleman would not recognize his own fields. The inhabitant of the town would not recognize his own street. Everything has been changed, but the great features of nature, and a few massive and durable works of human art. We might find out Snowdon and Windermere, the Cheddar Cliffs and Beachy Head. We might find out here and there a Norman minster, or a castle which witnessed the Wars of the Roses. But with such rare exceptions, everything would be strange to us. Many thousands of square miles which are now rich cornland and meadow, intersected by green hedgerows and dotted with villages and pleasant country seats, would appear as moors overgrown with firs, or fens abandoned to wild ducks. We should see straggling huts built of wood and covered with thatch, where we now see manufacturing towns and seaports renowned to the farthest ends of the world. The capital itself would shrink to dimensions not much exceeding those of its present suburb on the south of the Thames. Not less strange to us would be the garb and manners of the people, the furniture and the equipages, the interior of the shops and dwellings. Such a change in the state of a nation seems to be at least as well entitled to the notice of a historian as any change of the dynasty or of the ministry. One of the first objects of an inquirer who wishes to form a correct notion of the state of a community at a given time, must be to ascertain of how many persons that community then consisted. Unfortunately, the population of England in 1685 cannot be ascertained with perfect accuracy, for no great state had then adopted the wise course of periodically numbering the people. All men were left to conjecture for themselves, and, as they generally conjectured without examining facts, and under the influence of strong passions and prejudices, their guesses were often ludicrously absurd. Even intelligent Londoners ordinarily talked of London as containing several millions of souls. It was confidently asserted by many that during the 35 years which had elapsed between the accession of Charles I and the Restoration, the population of the city had increased by 2 million. Even while the ravages of the plague and fire were recent, it was the fashion to say that the capital still had 1.5 million of inhabitants. Some persons, disgusted by these exaggerations, ran violently into the opposite extreme. Thus Isaac Vossius, a man of undoubted parts and learning, strenuously maintained that there were only 2 millions of human beings in England, Scotland, and Ireland taken together. We are not, however, left without the means of correcting the wild blunders into which some minds were hurried by national vanity, and others by a morbid love of paradox. There are extant 3 computations which seem to be entitled to particular attention. They are entirely independent of each other. They proceed on different principles, and yet there is little difference in the results. One of these computations was made in the year 1696 by Gregory King, Lancaster Herald, a political arithmetician of great acuteness and judgment. The basis of his calculations was the number of houses returned in 1690 by the officers who made the last collection of the hearth money. The conclusion at which he arrived was that the population of England was nearly 5.5 millions. About the same time, King William III was desirous to ascertain the comparative strength of the religious sects into which the community was divided. An inquiry was instituted, and reports were laid before him from all the dioceses of the realm. According to these reports, the number of his English subjects must have been about 5,200,000. Lastly, in our own days, Mr. Finlayson, an actuary of eminent skill, subjected the ancient parochial registers of baptisms, marriages, and burials to all the tests which the modern improvements in statistical science enabled him to apply. His conclusion was that, at the close of the 17th century, the population of England was a little under 5,200,000 souls. Of these three estimates, framed without concert by different persons from different sets of materials, the highest, which is that of King, does not exceed the lowest, which is that of Finlayson, by 1/12. We may, therefore, with confidence pronounce that, when James II reigned, England contained between 5 million and 5,500,000 inhabitants. On the highest supposition, she then had less than one-third of her present population, and less than three times the population which is now collected in her gigantic capital. End of part 1.